just some mathematical ideas about classification. I'm not going to talk very much about practical things. And then the main thing I want to do is introduce maximum likelihood estimation and why it, how it, give you an idea of how it works. Hello, test 1, 2. Yeah, it's just barely on. So I'm borrowing heavily from lecture notes by my colleague Hemant Tagari. So everything that's correct in this lecture is from Hemant, and everything that has errors is from me, of course. So I want to talk about clustering for just a minute. I think just to give people an idea of what that looks like and the problem of detecting heterogeneity in two-dimensional images, and then I want to talk about maximum likelihood estimation. So we've never worked on a particle big enough to detect heterogeneity, so I have to borrow other people's data. So this example from Eva Nogales' lab is really, really nice because this RNA polymerase exists in two conformations, and the two conformations are easy to tell apart because one is blue and the other one is yellow. And so how can we describe the difference between these two three-dimensional volumes? Well, one way, which is something I learned in reading Jochen's book, is the idea of plotting points in a very high dimensional space. What we do is we say each one of these is actually it's a three-dimensional map. We have a set of voxels in a three-dimensional space. Well, let's say we have m voxels, and then we plot the intensity of the map in at each voxel as a point in an m-dimensional space. So if we have a million voxels here, then we have a million-dimensional space where this axis might represent the intensity of one voxel. That would be the intensity of another. That would represent the intensity of another. And I don't know how to plot in higher than a three-dimensional space, but you're supposed to imagine that this is a 1 million-dimensional space. And then any unique map then describes a point in this high-dimensional space. And so there are two points for these two structures. Now, one way of detecting heterogeneity would be to do a large number of independent 3D reconstructions. And I think Holger Stark's lab is probably the champions at this, and I think we'll hear from him about doing multiple random conical tilt reconstructions and then trying to classify in three dimensions. And here's what the classification problem would look like. So we have we have in this case something like 100 different reconstructions, 100 different three-dimensional volumes, each represented by a point here. And in this case, again, the structures are very nicely color-coded so that all of the red or orange ones came from the orange conformation, all the blue ones came from the blue conformation. But in real life, we don't know which is which. And this is really the classification problem. If we have this kind of cloud of points, how are we going to know which are the underlying structures? So you have to remember that each one of these points represents a different, unique 3D map. And so one way of describing this problem is to say, what are the underlying true noiseless 3D maps that are represented by these maps that have a lot of scatter? And the reason they have scatter is that they have noise in them. And I didn't give you a picture of them, but that's what they have, noise. So one way of doing this is to do clustering. That is, what you do is you start out saying, I have 100 points. I'll call that 100 clusters, and then I start fusing them together. So I'm describing Ward's algorithm for clustering. And so so what happens is that I collect, for example, a group of points here into one cluster, and I plot its centroid there. Here are then 16 centroids of clusters. And as I proceed, I can merge these clusters into a few more, and I can merge clusters into just two, for example. But I don't know where to stop. There is nothing here that tells me, when to stop clustering. And so so the net result would be, if I were to then convert these points back into actual 3D volumes and look at them, I would see that here are four different 3D volumes, and they look a little bit different. And can't really tell if there are four conformations or two by this. Now, this is a particularly hard problem because in this imaginary picture, I picked two conformations that are pretty close together, and they're hard to tell apart. In fact, they're hard to tell apart in this 3D plot. And if I were plotting the entire 1 million dimensional plot, the problem would actually turn out to be much more difficult. There's a phenomenon called the curse of high dimensions, which says that if you have two points that are a little distance apart, there's going to be an uncertainty because of noise and scatter in all of the many dimensions. And in three dimensions, this scatter is on the order of square root of 3 times the standard deviation of the pixel noise. In a million dimensions, it's like the square root of a million times the pixel noise. So it becomes harder and harder to distinguish things in a high-dimensional space. Now, we can get around that by reducing the dimension of space by doing a principal component analysis, or MSA, the multivariate statistical analysis. Even so, I think you can see two of the problems. One is, if you have overlapping noisy distributions of things, it's hard to tell how many there are, and it's hard to tell them apart uniquely. If they're far enough apart, you can easily discover the centers of the clusters, but if they're close together, it's difficult. Now, then there's a more complicated problem, which is, suppose I have my two structures and I want to distinguish the projections, that is, the actual particle images coming from the two different conformations. So what I did was, again, because we don't have any particles where we can actually see heterogeneity ourselves, I downloaded Eva's maps of this RNA polymerase. Here is the blue conformation. Here's the red conformation. You can see that, and then I computed projections from them. You can see the projections are pretty similar, but they're not exactly the same. You can see some difference there, and you can see some difference there. So the projections are slightly different. Now, if I then do a principal component analysis and reduce each of these images, which has n pixels, down to a small number of principal components and plot them as I rotate the three-dimensional object through an angle around one axis and plot the positions in this component, in this coordinate system, it traces out a curve. I am doing a rotation around a single axis, and the image is changing in a continuous fashion, and it's periodic. So I trace out a closed curve in this space. And so you can see here that the curves for the blue and the red conformations are similar, but they're far apart from each other in some cases. They get really close together in other cases. The problem then is, if we have a more realistic situation where there is noise in the images, can we sort those projection images apart? Represented in this three-dimensional space, each image would be one of these black dots. And out here, you might be able to say, well, you know, I could cluster some points there and say that that's an image of the blue conformation, and cluster some points there, that's an image of the red conformation. But in these places where the curves get really close together, it's going to be very hard to tell the images apart. This is the basic issue, I think, in dealing with heterogeneity when all you have are these noisy projection images. there are ways to do classification better than just looking at the whole image. And I think that we'll hear from other people who are doing this, things like supervised classification or focused classification. Maybe you only look in a part of the image or in part of the 3D structure where the changes are occurring and don't worry about the whole image. That will increase your ability to discover differences. But the other thing that's needed is something that deals in a graceful way with a set of data that, like this, where in some cases you can tell the two conformations apart, and in other cases where you can't really distinguish. And it turns out that maximum likelihood techniques work well with that, and so I think that's why the organizers wanted me to talk about both of these topics at the same time. So having introduced the problem, let me now talk about maximum likelihood methods, which deal gracefully with the ambiguities of, in some cases, being able to tell two conformations apart in the images, and some cases that, and also in cases where you can't tell the two apart. So the idea of likelihood maximization is to think of a nice statistical quantity that you are maximizing as you're doing your reconstructions. The conventional align and average methods that we all use, you could describe what they are maximizing is the power in the reconstruction. If you align a bunch of images and then add them up, you will get a maximum power in the aligned average. And the idea of maximum likelihood is you're maximizing something that's like a probability. So here's a statement of the problem. We have a stack of images that I'm going to call the X's, N of them. And the idea is I want to find the best model that is a set of reconstructions. So I have these many images. What I want to do is I want to compute a M different three-dimensional models, M different coefficients, which tell me what fraction of the data set comes from each of those three different, of those M different volumes, and then some other parameters. I've just put here the noise standard deviation, but a good description would have more properties of the background noise. So then you'd say, well, all right, so what should we maximize? Why don't we maximize the probability of this particular model given the data that we have? That sounds like a good statistical quantity. But the statisticians will immediately blow the horn and say, you can't do that, because there is no such thing as the probability of a model. You have one model. So some people will say that you can't even define this. So one way to sort of backtrack is to compute something different. What we compute is the probability of seeing the data, seeing the images that we got, assuming that they came from this particular model. And this thing, which we treat as a function of theta of the model, we call the likelihood. So it's not the probability of the model; it's something else called the likelihood. Now, this quantity that I'm not allowed to call a probability is actually just the likelihood multiplied by the probability of the model in the first place, divided by the probability of seeing this data set in the first place. So this is an interesting quantity. I'll talk about it more in a second. What's the probability of seeing the particular data set? I don't know. So what do you do? Well, you just say this probability is some constant, and I don't know what its value is. So I'll just maximize this quantity and forget about these philosophical issues. So the maximum likelihood estimate optimizes this probability, which we call the likelihood, and this is kind of an idea of how it works. You get your experimental data, you maximize this thing, and you get a model. Now, there's a slightly more sophisticated way of doing all of this, which says Before the experiment, I know something. I know the size of my particle. I know my particle is sitting in the middle of ice, and so it's sitting in the middle of solvent, and the solvent should have a constant density, so I could do have a prior probability that says density fluctuations outside the molecular envelope ought to not be there. I can write down a so-called prior probability function, and that information plus the information from the experiment can then give me a model, and this is called the maximum a posteriori estimate of the model, and I'll talk about this a little more at the end. But for now, we'll just talk about the likelihood itself. Okay, so I'm going to do a couple simple examples to show you how likelihood maximization works. So we'll start with something really simple. We're going to say that we have a bunch of numbers. Here's a list of 10 of them. Here's a histogram of about 1,000 of them. We have a bunch of numbers that are Gaussian distributed, and we want to compute the mean and the standard deviation. How does this work by likelihood maximization? So these numbers are statistically independent, so the probability of seeing these numbers given a particular model is just the measurement resolution times the probability density of getting the first number's value times the same thing of the second number's value all the way up to the nth number's value. So I'm saying that the probability of seeing this particular data set, just the product of seeing each one of these quantities. And the probability of seeing the quantity is going to be a Gaussian probability density times this epsilon, which sort of tells me how finely I can measure it. And so the idea then is we want to maximize this quantity. Okay, so is that clear? Well, no. So in this case, what I'm saying, let's suppose that x is, you know, suppose standard deviation is on the order of 1, and let's suppose that I am measuring this with a voltmeter, and my voltmeter has a resolution of 0.01 volts. Then epsilon would be 0.01. Turns out epsilon's going to disappear in a minute, so you don't have to worry too much about it. But to be rigorous, this is. Oh, okay. So this is this thing that I would really like to compute, even though the mathematicians won't let me call it a probability. This is the probability of the particular model I propose as given the data that I have. That's what I'd really like to maximize. I would like to get the most probable, 3D reconstruction given my data. The philosophical problem is that you can't call the parameters of a model a random variable, but I'm going to do it anyway. On the other hand, this quantity is not only questionable to define, but it's really hard to compute. But I can compute some of these things. I can compute this thing, which is the likelihood. It's the probability of seeing the data, assuming those values of the parameters of the model. Okay. Is that good enough? Well, I'm not sure how to compute it. Okay, I just ignore it. I just say it's a constant. Yeah, yeah. Let's let it be one. Yeah. Okay. All right. So this is the likelihood. Remember, is the probability of seeing the data given the model. So I have a model that looks like this. It has model parameters, which are the mean and the standard deviation. And so this probability of seeing this particular set of data is given by that. Okay, so this number is really, really small. So everybody computes the logarithm of it. And so here's the logarithm of the likelihood and the logarithm of this guy is just this, the sum of the logs of each of those terms, and I can go and write out the expression for this. And so we maximize it. We ask what is the derivative of this likelihood with respect to the mean mu, and it turns out that our estimate of mu that maximizes it is just the average value of all of my numbers. That's sounding pretty reasonable. And the derivative with respect to the standard deviation gives me an equation that looks like this, that says that the square of the standard deviation is just the square differences between the original numbers and the mean. So this is very reasonable. This is exactly the same as a least squares estimate of these values. And so that says maximum likelihood isn't all that mysterious. It's just a complicated way to get the mean and standard deviation the way we would expect from a set of numbers like this. Now, a famous example for maximum likelihood is a mixture of two Gaussian distributions. So now what I'm saying is that the underlying probability distribution is the sum of two Gaussians. So here's F1 and here's F2. And F1 or F2 is each one of these is one of these Gaussian probability densities, but I have a mixture. A1 and A2 are the mixture coefficients. And so now it's the same thing. For each value x sub I, I'm going to evaluate the probability density at that value, and I'll multiply it by epsilon. Oh, where did epsilon go? It's a constant, and so I don't care about it as I'm maximizing. So the likelihood, I can write out the equation for the log likelihood, and it looks like this. And it's going to be complicated to maximize this because you have this log of the sum of two exponentials, and it's going to be really messy to write out those derivatives. So here's the strategy. Suppose we had extra information in the form of a switch variable. So this switch variable z tells me whether a given random value of x came from this Gaussian or from that Gaussian. And so if I had this extra information, I could say, well, you know, that random number came from distribution 1, that one came from distribution 2, that one came from distribution 1, and so on. If I had that information, then I could easily compute all the parameters of this problem. I could compute the two means, and I could also compute the two standard deviations if I wanted. I'm just going to talk about computing the two means. So what I do is I use this switch variable to tell me whether or not a given x sub I belongs to distribution 1, and so I just compute the average of all of those that belong to distribution 1, and I use 1 minus the switch variable to pick up distribution 2, and that allows me to pick up the two means, and I can also pick up the two quantities. So if I have this insider information, I can easily solve the problem. But in this case, as the original problem was, I don't know which number came from which distribution. So here's the trick. Let's just estimate the values of these switch variables, not knowing exactly what they are. Let's compute what's called the expectation value. And the way we do it is we say that this switch variable z sub I is just the probability that a given x sub I came from distribution 1. So I compute it as this probability density in distribution 1 divided by the total probability density, and I could define another switch variable z2, which is just 1 minus that. It's the probability that it came from the other. So the idea then is let's use these fake switch variables, this estimated switch variable, in doing the calculation. So the idea is we saw that if we knew the true switch variables, we would be able to get the two means. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to use these estimated values of the switch variables to compute the two means. So here's an example of a computer program that does this. So there are my data plotted as a histogram. Here is the probability density of one part of the distribution with the wrong mean. The mean is way out there, and there's the probability density of the other distribution, which has a mean out here. And here's my estimated switch variable. So my switch variable says if I'm kind of over on this side, the switch variable gets close to 1. And if I'm over on this side, the 1 minus switch variable gets close to 1. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this estimated switch variable, and I'm going to use it to weight the sum that I compute of all the random numbers. So the way this works out is here's now my histogram plotted by this function z. And so you can see that only this part of the histogram is left. And I compute the mean of that, and I call that now my estimated mean of that distribution. I can do the same thing on the other side. So this is the start of my little algorithm. And once I compute a mean here, then I can move this Gaussian over to the new mean value, and I can compute new set of switch variables and do that. And if I go around the loop 25 times, I finally reach a stationary state where I have my two Gaussians. We have the switch variable computed from them, and this is what the histogram weighted by that switch variable does. Turns out that this comes up with the right answer. I get the right means of these two Gaussians, and I did it by a very simple calculation where I made use of the switch.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Go back.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So, you could say that another way to handle this problem would be to say, okay, I'm going to draw a line down the middle, and I'm going to call all the values to the left of that line one class and all the values to the right of the line another class, and I could compute those two means. I'd get the wrong value. Those two means would be a little bit too far apart. But that would be what I call a hard classification.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. No. The only thing that the maximum likelihood is promising is it'll give me the two mean values correctly.
Right.
But it's not promising me that I'm doing the classification correctly.
I realize it's not
really So if all we care is to get out the means and we don't really care which of the x of I belong to one class or the other, then this is a really cool way to do it. Yeah. And in fact, this classification is soft in the sense that in this region, we don't know whether the original numbers came from, which distribution the original numbers actually came from. Okay, so let's get a little bit formal about this. So, yeah. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so the classification is no longer binary, but it can then contribute according to some figure of merit.
Yes.
Based on in this case, your z function.
Right. And if the weighting happens to be the correct probability function, then you actually get the right answer. Yeah. Okay. So let's generalize this a little bit. So here is my set of observed data, and These z's is a set of hidden variables. So these are, for example, my switch value. And we suppose that it's easy to compute the probability if we have both the observed and the hidden variables. That was the example of these two Gaussians. It's really easy to compute the means if we know the switch variable. So if we had the complete data, then we can really we can get the answer quickly. So the we can write down a likelihood based on this quantity. For example, it looks like this. The log likelihood looks like the probability of the complete data given the model multiplied by the probability of these hidden variables given the data and the model. So this is the weighting that we were doing on the complete data in the previous slide. Okay, so in our case, for doing, say, a 3D reconstruction, our data is the set of images, and these hidden variable z is the set of alignment parameters. We have a large number of images. We don't know they're in general translated and rotated and represent unknown views of a three-dimensional particle. If we knew, if we had this hidden data, then it would be easy to do the reconstruction. It would just be tomography. So the idea of using maximum likelihood in this case is we're going to integrate over these hidden variables. We'll do this kind of weighting. So we do tomography with the values of the hidden variables as a weighting function.
So z is no longer which of two conformations?
No. So actually, z would also be which conformation also.
Oh, that's part of z.
Yeah, that would be part of z also. Okay, so there are some things in my slides which are outlined in yellow, and those are cases where I made a mistake, where my mistakes actually were obvious, and I corrected them here, but not in your notes. Okay, so so what I've been talking about, this method with the hidden variables, is a famous algorithm called the expectation maximization algorithm, what it says is if you maximize a particular quantity, which is this quantity Q, then there's a theorem that says that will then maximize the likelihood itself, and this quantity Q is not too hard to work with. So Q is now the log of the probability of the complete data, and you are forming an expectation value. You're forming an integral where you vary all of the z's and weight them by the probability of the different z values. So this is still the same idea. We're using z's to weight this quantity, and then we're going to maximize these by maximizing the Q function. So let me give you a third example, which is a one-dimensional alignment. So what I'm going to align is I'm going to say I have a pulse which arrives at a random time within a certain window of time, and I don't know the arrival time, and I'm going to try to reconstruct it. So here's what this Q function looks like. This is the log of the complete probability. I'm assuming Gaussian noise. And so what I say is the observed function, which has noise on it, I'm going to translate it by a value z. So z is the translation of arrival time. And I'm going to compare it with my observation y. And I'm going to weight it by the probability of this amount of translation, z, given all the information that I have. It turns out that the way that I then get a new estimate, y, of this pulse, of this one-dimensional function that I'm trying to estimate, is I try out all possible translations T sub Z operating on the original signal. And I wait, so I'm taking copies of my data. My data might look something like this. I'm going to translate this. I'm going to add together all possible translated copies of it, and I'm going to weight them by, once again, a P of Z, where Z is my hidden variable, and this P of Z looks like this. It is a Gaussian that looks at the deviation between the translated copy of the data and my current estimate of the recovered signal. So here's the result of a simulation like this. So this is what I would call a signal-to-noise ratio of 1. So I have this big Gaussian noise on top of my pulse, and what I do is in the EM algorithm iteration, I add up copies of this that are translated, and the weighting factor on all of these translated copies is this P of Z. At this good signal-to-noise ratio, it's very obvious what the correct value of translation is going to be, because this P of Z has a very sharp peak. And so when I add them all up, I recover a pulse. It's maybe shifted because I started off with a random starting value. Now, when the signal-to-noise ratio gets low or even lower, it's interesting to see what happens to this P of Z. At a low level, you see I'm starting to get peaks in various places, and at a really low signal-to-noise ratio, this weighting function P of Z is really broad, has lots of peaks, is really random looking. So, in fact, in order to do this reconstruction here, what I did was I took each data trace and did the random translation, did all possible translations, weighted them by this funny-looking function, and then added them all up. And I started with a very large number of data. What is that? 300,000 of the simulated data, but I was able to recover this little pulse. So this gives you an idea of how the maximum likelihood can work in cases where it's really hard to tell things apart. You know, like I'm trying to detect this pulse whose amplitude is only 1/10 the standard deviation of the noise. And you can see in these cases, this probability function, which is sort of picking out what translation to use, there's a lot of ambiguity in the data. Whereas here, when the signal-to-noise ratio was good, it's really obvious. I mean, this thing has basically said, you know, there's a certain amount of translation that's the right amount, and it picks that one up. Okay, am I?
Right. In your analysis, it seems to be impossible to dig signals out of a signal-to-noise ratio of 0.01. Presumably, you're basing a priori information that there is a pulse there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, I could be estimating other parameters. I could, for example, be saying I have an arbitrary function and trying to figure out what that function is. So that would just be more parameters in the model. And that probably wouldn't work at quite as low a signal-to-noise ratio as here. So this is a simple example where I'm just trying to do an alignment. But yeah, it's maybe a bad example, because in our case, what we're trying to do is we're trying to not only align something, but also find out what the signal is in the first place.
So these pulses come in at a random time in this interval.
Yeah.
And you want to know what the pulse looks like.
Yeah. 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 I have a MATLAB program I can show you, but I better not do that now. Watch it run. Okay. This is a whole slide that's not in your notes. That's what this means. Okay, so applying this algorithm to 3D reconstruction looks something like this. The model is all of the volume maps that we want to determine the relative proportions of these different maps, and also maybe some noise parameters. The hidden variables are the translation and rotation of the particle in each image, and also a switch variable which tells which particle type is in each one of the images. And then the EM algorithm, which maximizes the likelihood, looks kind of like this. We have this Q function, which we evaluate from the combination of the actual data and the hidden variables. And we form an expectation value where we integrate over all possible values of the hidden variables and weight them by the probability of the hidden variables. And so then we just maximize this whole thing and with respect to each parameter. So formally, we are maximizing this with respect to the value in each voxel of each reconstructed volume, for example. So what do some of these quantities look like? So this probability of the complete data, so this is image and this is translations, rotations, this is the switch variable. If we say that that our image is just a true image plus Gaussian noise independent in each pixel, then this is what it looks like. This probability is saying, let's take the volume V dot kappa, and we form a projection of it, and we compare that with the ith image. We take the squared sum of the squared differences between the two. We exponentiate that. That is then the probability that's a probability density that this image came from that volume in the presence of this much noise. So this is that whole probability density. The probability of the hidden variables is just a combination of these guys. So the probability of the hidden variables is exactly the same probability as that one, normalized by the integral over all of the hidden variables. So that's our switch probability. So then all we have to do is to maximize this thing. And the thing that is that you should remember is that this is a lot of work, because what we're doing is we are integrating over all possible values of the 5 degrees of freedom particles, 3 Euler angles, and translations, and we're also summing over the different different 3D models. So it takes a lot of computation. But here's what the 3D reconstruction looks like. So I gave you this equation. I didn't give you this equation. I just want you to look at this to sort of see what's involved. So to get a new volume estimate, what we have to do is we have to do some kind of reconstruction where we have a back projection operator, for example, where we do a back projection in any of the many different possible angles and with any of the possible translations, and then we weight that back projection by this switch probability, which I've written here with the denominator making it into the switch probability. So this is why the method is expensive, is that you have to do what amounts to an exhaustive search. You can't just in principle search a neighborhood. You have to search all possible angles, translations, and so on. But you can imagine that if you have an easy problem, the signal to noise ratio is really good, this function might have a really sharp peak at the right alignment. In which case, this thing reduces to the conventional sort of, let's pick out the right alignment, and we'll just do the back projection in the directions of the proper alignment angles. I want to back up and show you that this function could have a really sharp peak. Because what is this? So this is an exponential function where I am comparing every pixel of an image with every pixel of a projected volume. Asking what the squared deviation is summed over the thousands of pixels of an image. And that sum of squares I'm just dividing by 2 times the variance. So This is, in general, a pretty big number, and this is, in general, not so big a number. So I'm talking about this is the variance in one pixel, and this is the sum of squares over the thousands of pixels in an image. So if my signal-to-noise ratio is at all good, this function could have a really sharp peak. And so the whole integration might not turn out to be quite as nasty as I said, and that's just to bolster my claim that it reduces in a good signal-to-noise case into a case where all we are doing is, with this probability function, is picking out, is picking out a back projection in the right direction of each of our images. Okay, so so this is the thing that has to be maximized. Here's a here's how it would look in a simple case where we're not taking into account any contrast transfer function effects. Turns out that solving this is much more complicated in the case where when you include the CTF, because there are zeros in the CTF, and that means that you have to solve this equation by algebraic method. Okay, so. So Shores Sheras in the Carrazzo group has implemented a version of this that actually takes into account the contrast transfer function, not in a perfect way, but in using a Wiener filter. And it's been quite successful in separating out different volumes, different conformations of things like ribosomes. So I think, if I know enough about ribosomes, this is an elongation factor, and this is one of the transfer RNAs. And so in this example, they were able to sort out basically two different molecular configurations, one that had the transfer RNA in place and one with the elongation factor in place. So this is just to say that if we remember the original problem, which was we had this cloud of points representing different possible images, and in some cases we could tell the images apart because those lines were far apart, in other cases they weren't. The EM algorithm and maximum likelihood handles this sort of ambiguity gracefully because of this whole idea of the switch variable and estimating the switch variable in the case of each image. Yeah. Oh, David?
So, Fred, I was just going to ask, are there ways of capturing most of the benefit with a tiny fraction of the computational cost by, essentially, like, for example, translations in practice may be well-behaved.
Yeah. Right.
And rotations, the biggest issue is probably if you have multi-valued rotations, that you have sort of one cluster of orientations and another cluster of orientations that are, give significant correlations.
Right.
And so, are there ways of then just using sort of defining things and using some figure prototype statistics?
Yeah.
So you're not doing reconstructions for every single orientation and every single translation. You're just focusing it with some overall statistics in a couple of neighborhoods that are set up gracefully based on the full search.
Yeah, yeah. So there are a couple of approaches to that. So Nico, I think, is going to talk about his poor man's maximum likelihood, which is a very nice kind of extreme approximation. The other is to try to coarsely look at this probability function on a coarse grid and only then do the integral in a fine grid, yeah. And so Hemant and Andy Barthel and I have been working on that. Yeah, so it's possible to get, order of magnitude or two speed up over a very slow program by doing something like that. Finally, before turning it back to Nico, I want to come back to this maximum a posteriori estimation. Okay, so I was saying that there is this way in which you can use prior information formally in the process and so get a better result by incorporating the prior information. A very simple bit of prior information would be to say, let's suppose I know something about my translational errors. Let's suppose that in particle picking or in the simple alignment, I think that I have a certain standard deviation of error of the position of centering of my particle. I can include this formally into my calculations with a so-called prior probability term. And another example that I mentioned before was this idea of solvent flattening. I know beforehand certain characteristics of the map that I want to get. Okay, with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Nico, who's going to tell us about poor man's maximum likelihood and other interesting topics.
All right. A few more equations for you guys. David has already, was it you, asked about making how to capture the essence of maximum likelihood, perhaps without doing the nasty integration. And actually, Fred described a way in his 98 paper, where he set up the whole maximum likelihood processing of images in the 2D case. And so we don't need to dwell on this slide too much. It's just, this is the likelihood function that you would try to optimize or maximize in the full-blown maximum likelihood case. And what Fred pointed out in his paper in 1998 was that at high signal noise, you have a pretty peaky joint probability function here. And instead of evaluating this entire integral, you just need to look at the places where this is not zero and maximize this function instead of this function. Okay, so you maximize the integrand instead of maximizing the likelihood itself. That's essentially what he says in his paper, that at reasonably high signal noise ratio, you can do this. So reasonably high signal noise ratio means that when you look at your correlation map, if you could do this, in 2D, you can obviously plot an entire correlation map, but in 3D, including all three angles and XY shifts, this would be a very big map that nobody ever calculates. But if you could do this, a reasonably high signal noise ratio would be one where you can clearly identify a correlation peak that says this is the, within this peak is the correct alignment. And we can talk a little more about this if you want. But anyway, so then what he said in his paper is that you are just trying to find the alignment parameters to maximize the integrand here. Okay, and that's the same as maximizing this or maximizing this. So this comes from the way the probability was formulated in one of Fred's earlier slides, where basically you have a correlation coefficient plus an extra term that may include this a priori information about the distribution of the x and y coordinates. Okay, so... And that's, I think, is important here because in the next slide I'm going to show you what the effect this might have. So this is, for high signal noise ratio, you go back to maximizing a correlation coefficient, which most of us have done up to now anyway, plus an additional term that comes in if you know anything else about your data, like, for example, you picked your particles usually in the middle somewhere, and therefore when you look at the displacements in X and Y, it should be as a first approximation, a Gaussian distributed function in x and y, where most likely you find your particle somewhere in the middle, but then, you know, with a certain likelihood, it's also a little bit displaced from the center. And so this is contained in this function here. And the parameters here, you know, just like what Fred had before, also the model parameters that would, for example, include a description of the distribution of x and y, and would also include a noise level in your data. I've shown it here explicitly, sigma. So this is what you would maximize if you had a high signal noise ratio and could therefore avoid the integration. So I wanted to investigate what effect this extra term has. So this is just repeating what it said and showing explicitly what this function would look like if it was just a Gaussian distribution of x and y. You would have x naught and y naught describing basically around which point the particles are distributed. It could be just the center of your image, of your box, box dot particles. This is the width of the distribution, so how accurately you actually pick your particles. And then x and y are the coordinates that that you find for any particular particle. So if you add this term to the normal correlation coefficient in your alignment, then you find that the reconstruction that you get at the end with these types of with this restraint alignment is a little bit better than what you get without this kind of restraint. Okay, so this is going back to the earlier data set with 30,000 particles that I showed you. And so the restraints in this particular case, at least, seem to help a little bit in getting the alignment of the parameters a little more correct. Okay, so it's not a huge difference, but helps a little bit. So I thought I would try this kind of thinking also for classification. So in the classification case that Fred described, again, to do this correctly, you have to integrate over all your alignment parameters plus this partitioning function or switch variable, whereas I simply try to replace the switch variable with an estimate. So this, what was the switch variable for Fred is basically my Q here. Images X are summed with a certain weight that can be between 0 and 1, but not exactly 0 or 1, which I think was assumed for the switch variable. That could be either 0 or 1. So here I'm allowing, this is an expectation value, essentially, of the switch variable. It could be 0.3, 0.4. And so this is a weighted average of these images to calculate a new average. Fred called it V. I called it A, according to his old paper. And so this is how you would calculate the proportion for each image. It's essentially, again, just the joint probability function. So again, I'm not doing the integration. I'm just looking at the integrand and plug in the alignment parameters that I found for a particular particle. And this is the A function that Fred also described, essentially a partitioning function that would say for the first class, maybe we have 30% of the particles, so 0.3 for the second class, 50 and or whatever. So this contains information about the overall data set, whereas this here is a probability for a particular particle with particular alignment parameters and a particular reference that is stuck in here with the model parameters. And so this is a probability divided by the sum of all probabilities, so you get a new one that you plug in here. This is just the partitioning function that Fred also described. And so this essentially getting rid of the integration and instead determining the hidden parameters that Fred was trying to get rid of by integration explicitly. And I mean, of course, we do this. Traditionally, we do this. We have alignment parameters for each image, what Steve asked about. And for the classification, we also traditionally make a decision, an explicit decision, which particle, which image belongs to which class. Now, the difference between this traditional way of doing this and this here, there's a slight difference, because here I'm not making a decision about each image versus whether it belongs to class A, B, or C. I'm just saying it may belong to a certain percent to class A, B, and C. So it's a slightly softer way of assigning these. It's not, as I said, the full thing that Fred described, but it's also not this binary decision. And so just to run a few tests, I created these test structures, which is essentially a big ball, a smaller ball, and an even smaller ball. And so there are different degrees of signal that need to be sorted out. Then I generated a data set with 10,000 particles, CTF, applied, different orientations, and small displacements from the center. That looks like this. This has a signal noise ratio of 1, so you can see the particles really well. That's probably not realistic for most data sets, except maybe when you work with viruses. And so when you do the traditional correlation classification where you assign a particle to the class that gives the best or the highest correlation, you get back your input structures in the end. And when you look at the assignment of particles, it's essentially correct. 99.2% get correctly assigned at that signal noise ratio. And when you do this with this partial assignment where you give every particle a chance to belong to every class with a certain percentage, with a certain weight, it's not quite as good, but still, you know, very close to perfection. And again, the structures look like the input structures. But now when we go to a signal noise ratio of 0.1, so more noise, and repeat this, the binary assignment here doesn't work so well anymore. So the big ball here, it still sort of understands this classification scheme, still sort of understands that one of the classes should be missing that big ball. It's gotten it partially right, but the small one here didn't work at all. You know, remember, one of the structures here was missing the small ball. And when you look at the correctness, it's a little more than half correct. Whereas if you do the other type of alignment, the poor man's maximum likelihood classification, it's not as good as what it was with signal noise ratio of 1, but still good enough so that you can get these structures out according to what they were generated with. So it's a more practical way of using some of the lessons you learn from the full-blown maximum likelihood refinement. It's probably not as powerful as doing it the full-blown way, but it's a hell of a lot faster. So,
just a quick question. When you say it's 86.5 correct, since you're allowing different images to contribute to all the models, how do you come up with 80? If a model is 80% in this structure, and
yeah,
80%, do you take the 80% as being 0.8 correct?
Yeah, so I'm adding up the weights.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perhaps being big in the cover, can we go back and look at your images and see what the noise ratio is 0.1?
Yeah. Still pretty good. Much higher. Yeah. So what I'm trying to demonstrate here is a difference in performance. And I, you know, obviously the two algorithms saw the same data. But is this what you would get with a typical 500 kilodalton particle? Probably still too good.
Nico, I missed how you got this started.
Oh, how do I start?
What
yeah. Good question. So I mean, I know how I construct my data set in that I use reference 1 to generate this, reference 2 to generate this, and reference 3 to generate this. So the classes have a third of the data set has a third of each of the classes. And they are systematically ordered so that I can evaluate it, but the program doesn't know this. So when I start the refinement, I generate three starting structures by selecting the first third of my data set, the second third, and the third, and calculate reconstruction from those. So they are all of them mixtures and look like a mix of the three structures, but they're slightly different because they contain different data. And then the algorithm is, within 10 or 20 cycles, able to separate them completely. Yes, in this case, yeah. But there are ways to, I guess, come up with tests where you may assume a larger number, well, or a smaller number, and sort of adjust and see how the classification goes as you add or as you subtract classes, and whether you still get significant differences between the classes. I mean, different things can happen when you assume more classes than you actually have. One is that you end up with two classes that look very similar. And another one is that one class sort of dies out and becomes weaker and weaker. So, both cases.
So, I get the questions of the invariant angles and orientation for these rotations were known in the beginning when you mixed the data set and constructed.
They were known within about 10 degrees. So, they were roughly aligned. I was trying to simulate a case where you have a reasonable starting structure, reasonably good angles that you start with, but not exact.
Can we please switch back and forth between the greedies with 0.1?
These and these?
Yeah, to my eyes, the rightmost structure with your better statistics is lacking a significant important feature, this small bump.
Yeah,
so
So it is, it's not entirely.
Is that because you allow, class average to belong to both of them?
Yeah. I mean, this one sort of, it's this number that really is, I guess, more informative. There are still errors in here. There are errors in there, and you're right. So this one should have, no, actually, it's incorrect because, I'm sorry, I switched the. There should be one that doesn't have a small bump. And there should be one that doesn't have a large bump. And there should be one that has two bumps. So I guess I switched them around. I'm sorry. So there's one that has both bumps, there's one that has a small bump, and there's one that has a large bump. This one? Yeah, I mean, there isn't, all of them have two bumps, but to different degrees. So this is, yeah. What? No, this is sort of wrong. I mean, you don't want to, yeah, I think your confusion, which was for when you asked me about it also for 30 seconds, my confusion is that I switched these two. Should have been, yeah. At some point, there's no change anymore in the proportions for each particle. So, you get out a list of explicit numbers that for each particle, it belongs to some percentage to class 1, 2, and 3. And these things then, at some point, stop changing. Oh, yeah, I don't.
Is that something that the maximum likelihood method formally captures?
Yeah.
Right?
And this one wouldn't capture unless, so this wouldn't capture this. If you had the same particle, but sort of two classes that are just differently oriented, they would be treated as two different classes. So I guess you could build in a sort of another sort of search to see if classes, or to always make sure that classes are aligned against each other as best as they could be aligned.
But I mean, you can truly have a Boolean value, cross correlation, for example, versus orientation angle.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those should be put in explicitly weighted by.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you can use this way of handling the, also now when in cases where you have two possible orientations. Absolutely, but don't want to spread it out into two different classes, but just remain with one class. And then this formula would tell you how you should use these two different this one single image in two different orientations with which performance proportions, yes. Yeah.
So if you had done this with the full maximum latitude, would it have gotten it exactly right, even at that point?
Yeah, that's some...
What's the cost-benefit ratio? I mean, how long would it take to work?
So here, I mean, this is something that I did last week to basically show here. What I haven't done is run two cases against each other, which I can probably do only in 2D. If I want, I can do it in 3D with Jose Maria's if I reduce the resolution. I mean, the structure that I showed you there, I think, would take too long to refine with Jose Maria's procedure.
Too long,
Joachim, how long does it take to... Uh-huh. So, yeah. But one can test it in 2D. I think that would be a valid test, which I haven't done. So that's something that I'd like to do. My point here is that this is... It is the test that I did do was, compare the traditional classification with one that follows, I guess, lessons that we learn from maximum likelihood, but isn't maximum likelihood. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked to Fred about this just this morning because I think my impression of the whole formalism is that as long as you work with Gaussian distributions, and you should really get the same result when you maximize the integrand or the entire likelihood function. That's sort of my impression, my sort of more superficial understanding of this. And I think, I'd like to talk to Hermant and Fred more about this. The difference might be, and that I think is maybe your question, the convergence radius. How easy is it to arrive at the correct solution? And that there might be a difference. So you're going to talk about this in your talk? Or are you going to talk about this in your talk?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so then we can wait until your talk. Yeah.
With a smile on my face, the take-home lesson seems to be that one should improve the singleton norm.
It's true.
Or improve beam-induced motion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you have better images, then in a way, the good data can always look after itself. It doesn't, pretty much doesn't matter what you're going to do with it. It always will converge to the right structure. The problem occurs when you have weak signal to noise or a lot of heterogeneity that you don't treat properly. Okay, so.
Are we going to get to what?
You advance part of those courses. I'm kidding. I think most people
Okay, so Hemant and Hongwei Wong and I have been thinking some about the problem of what happens when there is a continuously varying structure that we're trying to capture. And the example, this is a molecule that Hongwei is working on, is Dicer. I think it's also being worked on here as well. This is an RNA processing enzyme, and in the absence of a substrate, it's pretty rigid, but with certain substrates, it's highly flexible. And you can see this base of the molecule exists in a variety of different conformations, and you know, it seemed like a case. Other cases would be, you know, the bending of a nucleic acid attached to a DNA or RNA binding protein, where there is a motion that you know is continuous and you want to somehow get a structure, hopefully at high resolution, even though all your particles look different. So the present way to deal with a problem like that is you have your stack of images and you make several reconstructions, and the more reconstructions you make, the better you capture this range of continuous motion. But of course, the more reconstructions you make, the worse the reconstructions get, because only a smaller population of images contribute to each of those reconstructions. So the idea behind the method that we're starting to think about is to use diffeomorphisms. These are differentiable, invertible homeomorphisms that allow you to morph one image into another. And the idea is that if we can come up with a set of continuous, smooth set of diffeomorphisms, we could describe a continuously varying structure as deformations of one high-quality, high-resolution structure. So the algorithm that we'd like to do but have not implemented in three dimensions looks like this. You start off doing a conventional multiple reconstruction by the usual techniques. So you do one iteration where you, either by maximum likelihood or by or other methods, you construct a set of different volumes which are related to each other, or which are similar to each other but have, you know, variations in this movable part. Then after you've done an iteration of that, then you go and you conform these volumes to being warpings of a sort of master volume. We call this the flex mean. And we do that by tuning up these diffeomorphisms both in forward and backward directions, so that all of these are warpings of this master volume. The idea then is that the master volume will wind up being the high quality, high resolution reconstruction. Well, so. We haven't done it in 3D, but we've done it in 2D, and here's kind of what it would look like. We start out with a large number of raw images. These were just selected to be the same preferred orientation view and negative stain of Dicer molecules. We start out with an initial set of these reconstructions. In this case, these are just two-dimensional class means. And after one, in the first iteration, here is what it looked like. We had a spectrum of initial class means, and this shows a variable number of particles being assigned to each one of those class means. And then after a number of iterations, it converges to a set of class means that are related by smooth deformations. And here are the populations of these initial class means. Here are the populations of these final class means. So the end result of this, of course, is to make the master reconstruction, the flex mean. And this is then a much higher quality reconstruction than any one of the original class means. So that's the story. This is as far as we've gotten with two dimensions, but you can see Hamant's poster if you want to know more about it. Yeah, David.
Just along the same lines, Rebecca and I have been doing things like this.
I see.
3D.
Uh-huh. Yes.
The ensemble projection. So, it's an exciting way of trying to deal with conformational heterogeneity.
Yes. Right. So in the 2D case, we're making a big assumption that all of those are the same view of the particle. And that's really just kind of trying out the 2D testbed for the algorithm. In 3D, there is an underlying assumption that these volumes can all be aligned reasonably, but there is one degree of freedom that is going to be then described by a three-dimensional warping of the volume, and so it would then be used to get the fundamental 3D volume.
And there may very well be ambiguities of coupling between those two parameters.
Yes.
So, for example, a simple motion like this, you can also change the orientation.
Yes. That's
and
right.
You'll get kind of a zero-order correlation with what the opening angle was.
Right.
Right. And
yeah.
So then one might need to do some sort of either weighted or maximum likelihood type thing so that that gets sorted out and doesn't bias the parameter determination.
Yeah.
The combination of information that you get.
Well, in a sense, the warping could also consist of a rotation.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, so it all depends on the constraints that are used in constraining these warpings to be smooth and continuous and so on. Yeah. We're trying to figure out what criteria to use. Probably David's running in the same thing. In general, we're sort of moving densities around with this warping, so it could be quite general. But we're on the other hand, we don't want to expend too much information on the details of the warping. So the easy cases would be to say we have a discrete domain that does its thing, and the rest stays stationary. We're not really sure how to set up the problem.
Alignment errors, confidence, by this warping.
Yeah. We obviously have no experience with this yet. I'm hoping that we can take examples where we really do expect a continuous motion in one part of the molecule and be able to have a built-in sanity check. Yeah.
There's an obvious resolution range where it makes sense, and but if you go beyond a certain resolution, then you get really get into secondary structure
yeah.
and so forth.
Yes.
And then everything breaks down.
Yeah.
Is it possible you could, for instance, apply this to the case of deformations of particles that are like sort of the normal mode? So one of the ideas is that very rigid particles, such as Zoe and Nico are talking about, get much higher resolution, but when they're not as tightly packed and so
yeah.
they move, so would this be applicable?
That's one of the fantasies is to do that. I'm a little worried about having I mean, 1 degree of freedom is easy to imagine and diagram, but then if we're talking about several degrees of freedom, it probably gets quite complicated.
The ultimate challenge is sort of what's the number of parameters that you can
yes.
extract from
yes.
the data.
Yeah.
Right? And that from a single view, that's going to be actually very limited, and there could be views where it's completely indeterminate. But if one takes multiple views, multiple tilts, then you start having more information that can help not only determine, but also
okay, that's all I had to say. Let's see, is it back to, no? We're done?
Yeah.
All right.